Okay, I say. Okay? He sounds confused. Okay, like, okay, fine? Yeah. Okay, fine. Chris thinks perhaps I do not understand. You have to give a speech. He says it slowly, loudly, like my hearing is going, like I really am old. But I heard him, and I am nervous, but it is time. This is a room full of women, powerful women. I am on the list. Theoretically, I am one of these powerful women. Theoretically, these are my peers. And yet, I don't actually know a single woman on the list. What this really is a room full of strangers, powerful strangers. I've been enjoying this year in a way I haven't enjoyed life in a long time. I'm excited and I'm vibrant and I'm feeling alive. I've made progress. I've gotten so much better at this, but I have no friends in the industry outside ones who work on my shows. Everyone I know works for me or with me. I'm a powerful woman who knows no powerful women. I am on the list, but not of the list. Chicken bone, Janet Jackson boob, fierce not, y'all. I've too long been a turtle in my shell with my sisters in the industry. It is time to stop standing at the edges of rooms, hugging the wall, living in my head, wishing I had something to say. If there's one thing I have learned from all of Chris's Sisyphean pushing and all of this saying yes, it's that if I don't poke my head out of my shell and show people who I am, all anyone will ever think I am is my shell. It's time to take my place on the list. On ceilings made of glass.
When my publicist called to tell me that I was receiving this honor, I'm going to be honest, I screwed up my face and I said, "Are you sure? Me?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because." I said, "No, really, why?" And then I made him call and ask for the written reason why I was getting this award. Because I was really and truly worried that there might have been some kind of mistake. Now, I want to pause here and say that I don't say these things to be self-deprecating and humble. I am not a self-deprecating and humble person. I think I'm pretty fantastic. But I also think the Hollywood Reporter Sherry Lansing Award is extraordinary, as is Sherry herself. So, no, really, why me? So they sent a written reason why I was getting this award. And it said many nice things, but the main thing that it said was I was getting the award in recognition of breaking through the industry's glass ceiling as a woman and an African American. Well, I call my publicist back, because I just don't know about this. I mean, I'm concerned now. I come from a very large, very competitive family, extremely competitive. And by competitive, I mean my mother says we're not allowed to play Scrabble anymore when we get together because of the injuries and the tears. And one of the rules in my family is you don't ever get a trophy for participation. You just don't get a trophy for being you. So the idea that maybe I might be getting a trophy because I'm a woman and an African American feels... I was born with a really awesome vagina and I have really gorgeous brown skin. I didn't do anything to make either of those things happen. I mean... To get all Beyoncé about it, I woke up like this. So, I mean, I know this isn't actually an award I'm getting because I'm a woman or because I'm African American. I know that it's really about breaking the glass ceiling that exists in the face of being a woman and being black in this very white, very male town. But I haven't broken through any glass ceilings. Do they know I haven't broken through any glass ceilings? I asked my publicist. He assures me that I have. I assure him that I have not. I have not broken through any glass ceilings. If I had broken through any glass ceilings, I would know. If I had broken through a glass ceiling, I would have felt some cuts. I would have some bruises. There'd be shards of glass in my hair. I'd be bleeding. I'd have wounds. If I had broken through the glass ceiling, that would mean I'd made it through to the other side, where the air is rare. I would feel the wind on my face. The view from up here, way up there where the glass ceiling is broken, that would be incredible, right? So how come I don't remember the moment when me, with my womanness and my brown skin, went running full speed, gravity be damned, into that thick layer of glass and smashed right through the glass ceiling? How come I don't remember it happening? Here's why. It's 2014. This moment right here, me standing up here all brown with boobs and my Thursday night of network television full of women of color, competitive women, strong women, women who own their bodies, women whose lives revolve around their work instead of their men, women who are big dogs. That could only be happening right now. Think about it. If you look around this room, it's filled with women of all colors in Hollywood, who are executives and heads of studios and VPs and show creators and directors. There are a lot of women in this room who have the game-changing ability to say yes or no to something. 15 years ago, that would not have been as true. There'd have been maybe a few women who could say yes or no. And a lot of junior execs and D-girls and assistants who would be gritting their teeth and working really hard. And for someone like me, if I was very, very, very lucky, there might have been one small show, one small shot. That shot would not have involved a leading actress of color. It would not have involved any three-dimensional LGBT characters, any women with both high-power jobs and families, and no more than two characters of color in any one scene at any one time, because that only happens in sitcoms. 30 years ago, I think maybe there'd be 1,000 secretaries fending off the handsy bosses back at the office, and two women in Hollywood in this room who could say yes. If I were here, I would have been serving those two women breakfast. 50 years ago, if women wanted to gather in a room, it better be about babies or charity work. And the brown women would be in one room and the white women would be in another room. From then to now, we've made such an incredible leap. Think of all of them. 50 years of trying to get out of separate rooms. 30 years ago, trying not to serve breakfast or being groped by your boss. 15 years ago, trying to make clear that they could run a department as well as that guy over there. All of the women, white, black, brown, who woke up like this, who came before me in this town, think of them. Heads up, eyes on their target, running, full speed, gravity be damned, towards the thick layer of glass that is the ceiling. Running, full speed, and crashing. Crashing into the ceiling and falling back. Crashing into it and falling back. Into it and falling back, woman after woman. Each one crashing, each one running, everyone falling. How many women had to hit that glass before the first crack appeared? How many cuts did they get? How many bruises? How hard did they have to hit the ceiling? How many women had to hit that glass to ripple it, to send out 1,000 little fractures? How many women had to hit the glass before the pressure of their efforts caused it to evolve from a thick pane of glass to a thin sheet of splintered ice? So that when it was my turn to run, it didn't even look like glass anymore. I mean, the wind was already whistling through it. I always could feel it on my face. And there were these holes giving me a perfect view to the other side. I didn't even notice the gravity. It had worn itself away, so I didn't have to fight that hard. I had time to study the cracks. I had time to decide where the air felt the rarest, where the wind was the coolest, where the view was most soaring. I could pick my spot and call my target and run. And when I finally hit that ceiling, I think it just exploded into dust. My sisters who went before me had already handled it. No cuts, no bruises, no bleeding. Making it through the glass ceiling to the other side was simply a matter of running on the path created by every other woman's footprints. I just hit at exactly the right point, exactly the right spot, exactly the right time. So I'm breaking my family's rule today. This is a trophy for participation. And I am beyond honored and proud to receive it because this was a group effort. I want to thank all the women in this room, and I want to thank all the women who never made it to this room. I want to thank all the women who will hopefully fill a room 100 times this size when we are all gone. You're all an inspiration. Thank you.
Hollywood Reporter Women in Entertainment speech, delivered December 10th, 2014, Los Angeles, California. Chapter 10. Yes, thank you. I was at a dinner celebrating women in TV, hosted by Elle Magazine and its editor-in-chief, Robbie Myers. It was one of the Yes events I'd made an agreement with myself to attend. In the beginning of the year of Yes, I dreaded these events. Small talk, nervous photographers. It was all too much. It made my brain freeze. But by this point, deep into the year, I found myself almost looking forward to these events. I was almost comfortable. I smiled for the photographers and made my way down the press line into the event, where I actually managed to exchange intelligent small talk with talented writers and actors I had long admired. Breathe in, breathe out. I no longer had that horrible sinking feeling that I always had at parties, that sad, runny nose pressed to the cold glass feeling of not belonging. There were no longer disturbing silences where people stared at me, waiting for me to speak. I no longer did the thing where I tried to stand as still as a marble statue in hopes that freezing my form would magically render me invisible to the naked eye. I was blessedly no longer worried about flinging a chicken bone across the room. And I only needed one pair of Spanx at a time these days. They were still too tight, but still, progress. I actually found myself thinking, this is going to be a great evening. Before dinner was served, Robbie Myers welcomed us. She was smart and funny as she called out each name and pointed all of us out. Then, explaining why they were chosen for the magazine's list of great women in TV, she named each woman's accomplishments. The accomplishments were innovative, bold, and impressive. A staggering number of powerful, accomplished women sat at that table. And yet, as the editor-in-chief pointed to each woman and named her powerful achievements, without fail, every single woman named did one of three things. One, shook her head and looked away, waving off the words and the ensuing applause as if to say, no, no, not really. Look, it's not as great as she's telling you. I maybe really was just mopping the floors and I tripped and fell and accidentally typed that whole script. Two, ducked her head, an embarrassed look on her face. Me? She's talking about me. Don't talk about me. Nobody should ever talk about me. Talk about someone else. If there were any kind of cheers when her name was called, she covered her face with her hands, almost as though she was trying to shield herself from a tragedy unfolding before her. Three, laughed, a mortified, embarrassed stunt. I can't believe I'm even sitting at this table with all of these awesome people, because what she is saying about me is the world's biggest lie, but they let me in the door anyway, laugh. Everything about her says, wow, just wow. I chose door number two. Robbie Myers rattled off a list of all the things that I'd done, all the work, all the ways I'd changed how women are portrayed on TV, how people of color are portrayed on TV, and I ducked my head down, shaking my head, covering my face with my hands, waiting for the attention and applause to go away. Nothing to see here, folks. Move on. Door number two. But when the editor-in-chief sat down next to me and very pleasantly said something like, now, where are you from, Shonda? Ohio, is it? I responded with, did you notice not a single woman in this room can handle being told she is awesome? What is wrong with us? The editor-in-chief blinked. I was not engaging in the rules of dinner conversation, which requires you to start with small talk, to start by wading in. I just leapt right into the deep end of the pool. She blinked. And then she smiled. And then we had one of the most honest and interesting conversations I have ever had with a complete stranger, while suffering a deficit of oxygen to my brain due to the tightness of my Spanx. But it stuck with me, bugged me, itched the back of my neck. Not a single woman in the room could handle being told, you're awesome. I couldn't handle being told I am awesome. What in the hell is wrong with us? I didn't have any answers. And not having any answers, I did what I was now starting to do in these situations. I decided to yes it, which is what I was finding myself doing more and more frequently. Instead of wallowing in the problem, I figure out what its yes would be. Sometimes this ends up being a ridiculous mind game, but most of the time it works. The point of this whole Year of Yes project is to say yes to things that scare me, that challenge me. So in order to yes a problem, I have to find whatever it is inside the problem that challenges me or scares me or makes me just freak out. And then I have to say yes to that thing, which feels like counterintuitive insanity. But slowly I'm coming to understand it's not insanity. I race into the wilderness, and it's all darkness and thorny bushes and rocky uphill paths, and I'm spitting out swear words left and right, and then suddenly I break through into the clearing and find I'm standing on a mountaintop, air in my lungs, sunlight on my face. It's not insanity. It's just tough. It's like surgery. You can't close the patient's chest until you've found the wound and operated on it. The problem is the open chest. The wound is the challenge, and the yes is the operation. You're making fun of me and my metaphor right now, aren't you? You are. I can feel it. Cut me some slack. I spent 12 seasons writing Grey's Anatomy, people. I can CBC, Chem 7, type cross, and match you in my sleep. Do you know how to diagnose appendicitis? Fever and tenderness over McBurney's Point. The common causes of post-op fever? The 5 W's, wind, water, walking, wounded, and wonder drugs. If you went into labor right now, I could perform a C-section on you. You don't want me to, but I could. And as any one of my writers who has been pregnant will tell you, I would. The point is, my metaphors are medical. The point is also that if you pass out in front of me, I will crack your chest and put you on an LVAD and start calling you Denny. So maybe try to stay conscious around me. Say yes to staying conscious. Anyway, I decide to do it. I decide that if it is so hard to own up to my own accomplishments, to take a compliment, to not duck my head and choose door number 2, then I'm going to say yes to accepting any and all acknowledgments of personal fabulous awesomeness with a clear, calm thank you and a confident smile and nothing more. I am going to say yes and just see what happens. It sounds much easier than it is. Someone says, I love your show. You know what I say back? I say, oh my God, I'm just so lucky, really fortunate. It's not me, it's everyone who works with me. Okay, look, everyone who works with me, they are amazing. I truly am surrounded by people, actors, line producers, directors, set decorators, costume designers, assistant directors, grips, craft service people, teamsters, writers, so many people who are incredibly talented and without whom Shondaland would literally not exist. There are a bunch of cool people at ABC who are pretty essential too. My agent Chris, my lawyer Michael, a lot of people make Shondaland the creative, happy, and successful place that it is. So it is everyone who works with me. But why am I running around saying it's not me? Because it is. It's me. It's me and it's them. It's us. And what the hell is up with the I'm just so lucky line? I'm not merely lucky. No one who succeeds is merely lucky. Not in the she tripped and fell right onto a television ratings chart way. Lucky implies I didn't do anything. Lucky implies something was given to me. Lucky implies that I was handed something I did not earn, that I did not work hard for. Gentle reader, may you never be lucky. I am not lucky. You know what I am? I am smart. I am talented. I take advantage of the opportunities that come my way, and I work really, really hard. Don't call me lucky. Call me a badass. Okay, now I'm going to admit something to you. That was all an act. There's a part of my brain that is screaming at me right now for giving myself all these compliments, screaming and wringing her brainy little hands and nervously hopping around. You cannot say that out loud. People will think you believe that you are. That I'm what? Into myself. Cocky, immodest, brazen, in love with myself. That I think I'm special. Shudder, shake, hop, flip out. I wrote that whole series of compliments to myself as part of my yes. And it was hard to do. I felt like a complete jerk the whole time I was writing it. And the sad part is, right up until I got to badass, those weren't even compliments. They were facts. Sadder? Did I just say that I'm actually worried that people will think that I am into myself? I'm worried that people will think that maybe I think I am special? That I am in love with myself? Wait, isn't that the goal? Don't people pay money to license therapists to get into themselves, to fall in love with themselves, to think that they are special? Now, let's all put our glorious Steinem cashmere thinking caps on and see if we can decipher this puzzler. What is the opposite of a cocky, immodest, brazen woman? Anyone? A meek, chaste, timid woman. Who, in the name of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Queen Bey, wants to be a meek, chaste, timid woman? Do you? Because I sure as hell don't. I'm outraged. But I still can't take a compliment. And neither can any of the other women I know. You know what? I don't think we've been raised to do so. Mindy Kaling went to Dartmouth College. I went to Dartmouth College. Actually, there's kind of a cool mafia of Hollywood women who went to Dartmouth. Connie Britton, Rachel Dratch, Aisha Tyler. What? Five is two a mafia. That's not the point. The point is that one day, I'm sitting around minding my own business when a member of the mafia, whom I don't actually know, but whose TV show I obsessively watch, calls me up. For reals. Mindy Kaling is on the phone. Now, to be clear, I don't watch a lot of TV during the TV season, because I'm working. But Mindy Kaling's show was something that I watched in real time when it aired, and I tried never to miss it. Mindy Kaling is on the phone, and she's asking if I will come and do a cameo on her show, The Mindy Project. Like act, like an actor, act like an actor on her show, the show that I watch in real time when it airs and never miss, the one that stars Mindy Kaling. This is a joke, right? I am being filmed, and later this will be on the internet, and people will laugh at me. All my high school terrors are coming true. It's definitely a joke. But it's not. She means it. Mindy Kaling is serious. She wants me to come act on The Mindy Project. Not give a speech. Not be a talk show guest. Be an actor. Acting. Playing a fictional version of myself, yes, but still, acting on TV. I don't really have a choice. I'm doing the year of yes. Also, I'm in love with her show. But also, Mindy is a Dartmouth sister, a member of the mafia. And Mindy is an FOD. First, only, different. I wonder how many questions she gets about being an Indian American woman. Probably as many questions as I get about being an African American woman. As an African American woman, how does it feel to fill in the blank? Here's a tip. The answer, no matter how you fill in that blank, is always the same. I don't know. Since I've never been anything other than a black woman, I can't tell you how specifically anything feels any more than someone could tell someone how things feel as a white woman. It's a creepy question. Stop asking it. I'm betting Mindy hates the FOD thing as much as I do. I say yes. Immediately after I say yes, I become terrified about the entire thing. I think about all the ways I can cancel. I think about getting a serious illness. The third Chris in my life. If you are keeping track, we have publicist Chris and godfather Chris. My agent, Chris Silberman, says there is no way I can cancel. He says that I said I would do it, and he told them I would do it. He says I am doing it. He says this very firmly. I think publicist Chris and agent Chris have been talking. Remind me to do something about that. Why am I so scared? I'm not worried about panicking during filming. I survived shooting Kimmel for a full hour. I can survive a few takes without hyperventilating. I'm not worried about being on set and the cast and crew being mean or making fun of me. TV crews are notoriously great people, and no one ever makes fun of guests on set anyway. I'm worried about what will happen when it airs. Not because of my acting skills. I don't think anyone is going to watch me and say, "My God, Meryl Streep better hang it up right now because here comes Shonda." I don't even think they're going to say that Joe at the community theater should hang it up. But I know I won't completely shame myself. Well, I might shame myself, but I have some TV shows, people. I understand the magic that can happen in an editing room. If I cover the Mindy Project set in shame, the producers of the show will kindly hide it in editing. And then, if they are wise, use the footage to blackmail me for the rest of my life. I am worried that people will be whispering, "Who does she think she is acting on a TV show? What, does she think she's all that? Does she have that high an opinion of herself? My, aren't we just a little bit in love with ourselves these days?" You heard me. I'm scared people will think I like myself too much. I am on Twitter, checking in on the world, and I see a tweet from some motherhood site. It says, "Sleeplessness is a badge of honor for moms." What? A badge of honor? Right then and there, my hair catches fire. My hair just lights up in flames of instant rage. The rage may be especially bad because I still have some PTSD from my oldest child's infant days. My perfect, beautiful, miracle baby never slept. Ever. Never. So neither did I. 12 years later, the memories of those nights, of that sleep deprivation, still make me rock back and forth a little bit. You want to torture someone? Hand them an adorable baby they love who doesn't sleep. Badge of honor? Necessary evil? Yes. Pain in the ass? Yes. Badge of honor? Are you freaking kidding me? Who believes that crap? Who is drinking that crazy Kool-Aid? But a lot of people are. Most people are. I don't think it ever occurred to me before how much and how often women are praised for displaying traits that basically render them invisible. When I really think about it, I realize the culprit is the language generally used to praise women, especially mothers. She sacrificed everything for her children. She never thought about herself. She gave up everything for us. She worked tirelessly to make sure we had what we needed. She stood in the shadows. She was the wind beneath our wings. Greeting card companies are built on that idea. Tell her how much all the things she does all year long that seem to go unnoticed really mean to you. With a $2.59 card. Mother's Day is built on that idea. This is good, we're told. It's good how mom diminishes and martyrs herself. The message is, mothers, you are such wonderful and good people because you make yourselves smaller, because you deny your own needs, because you toil tirelessly in the shadows and no one ever thanks or notices you. This all makes you amazing. Yuck. What the hell kind of message is that? Would anyone praise a man for this? Those are not behaviors anyone would hope to instill in their daughters, right? Right? I'm not saying motherhood shouldn't be praised. Motherhood should be praised. Motherhood is wonderful. I'm doing it. I think it's great. There are all kinds of ways and reasons that mothers can and should be praised. But for cultivating a sense of invisibility, martyrdom, and tirelessly working unnoticed and unsung, those are not reasons. Praising women for standing in the shadows? Wrong. Where's the greeting card that praises the kinds of mothers I know, or better yet, the kind of mother I was raised by? I need a card that says, "Happy Mother's Day to the mom who taught me to be strong, to be powerful, to be independent, to be competitive, to be fiercely myself and fight for what I want." Or, "Happy birthday to a mother who taught me how to argue when necessary, to raise my voice for my beliefs, to not back down when I know I am right." Or, "Mom, thanks for teaching me to kick ass and take names at work. Get well soon." Or simply, "Thank you, Mom, for teaching me how to make money and feel good about doing it. Merry Christmas." Where are the greeting cards for the kind of mother I try to be? For the kind of mother I need my kids to see? For the kind of mother I want my daughters to one day be? And if there is no greeting card, what is there? There is me. I have to be my own greeting card. And to do that, I have to at least be able to take a compliment. The first time I try to do it, it's pathetic. "That's a nice color on you." I'm in an elevator, just me and one other person, a nice-looking man. He's smiling at me. Why is the guy smiling at me? I'm notoriously bad at knowing when someone is flirting with me. Later, my friend Gordon will tell me, "Fool, he was flirting with you. He was trying to meet with your client." Meet with your client is Gordon speak for getting laid. See, the client is my moving on. I stare at this nice-looking man who maybe wants a client meeting, confused. He raises an eyebrow. "Speak, Shonda, speak." Finally, I get it together. What? That's what I say to him. And my what is not a cute, flirty, two-syllable uptalk at the end. What? My what is a flat, construction worker, get back to work, grunty, what? The potential client meter looks taken aback. That is a nice color on you, I said. I look down at my dress. It's cerulean blue. I only know that it's cerulean blue because Meryl Streep gave a breathtaking monologue on the color in The Devil Wears Prada. I love Meryl Streep's work. I know everyone does, but I really do, more than you. I love Meryl's work so much that no matter what role she's playing, I'm rooting for her character. So while many people think that The Devil Wears Prada is about how mean that boss lady is, I know they are wrong. To me, it's clear that it's a daring expose on how hard it is to find a good assistant. Meryl, by the way, probably knows how to take a compliment. Go, Meryl, in your cerulean blue. I actually pretty much thought all of that while standing in the elevator with this man, this client meter. You can see why I have a hard time with small talk. But my dress is cerulean blue, and he likes it. He likes it on me. Wait, he said he likes it. And I realize this is it. It's happening. My chance. Say it. Just say thank you, then smile. And don't say anything else. Don't offer any words of apology or remorse for having the audacity to wear a dress someone could like. Just stand there, confident and bold, like you too think this color is great on you. Thank you, I reply. Good. Smile, Shonda. Shut up, Shonda. I force myself to smile, which is where things go really wrong. I think maybe my mouth is really dry, or I'm nervous, or I'm so determined to do this right that my smile comes out, well, terrifying. Like a Buffalo Bill smile. Not the cowboy Buffalo Bill. The Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs who made you put the lotion on your skin or else you'd get the hose again. That smile. A horrifying, stretched, ghoulish clown face is what he must be seeing, because now this nice guy who was probably flirting with me moments earlier is pressed into the corner of the elevator away from me like I had become a zombie who wants to eat his face. So, instead of leaving it alone, instead of being all, whatever, do better next time, instead of letting a chicken bone be a chicken bone, I tried to explain to this poor man. That was freaky, right? The face? I was smiling, but I was totally not doing it right, because I say yes to compliments now, but I'm still not used to it, and you're kind of the first one, the test case, but I wasn't expecting it here in this elevator, you know, ha ha. So when you say the nice thing about the color, which is cerulean blue, by the way, I was just kind of ding. And the doors open, and the really nice, cute guy who likes this color on me runs for his life from the crazy lady in the elevator. To my credit, I don't chase after him and continue trying to explain. Believe me, I want to. But I can't. I am on my way to my gynecologist's office. Dr. Chen needs to meet with my client. A half hour later, Dr. Chen, well, I call her Connie because I say I must be on a first name basis with anyone who gets to be inside me. Connie is down between my thighs. My feet are up in stirrups. She's got her whole speculum swab thing going on, and right now she's shining a light right up my vajayjay, looking at who the hell knows what. Maybe she will find my dignity in there. You have a good uterus, Connie exclaims. I push myself up to rest on my elbows and look down at her. Thank you, Connie, I say. Then I smile. Then I don't say anything else. Not to brag or anything, but that is how it's done, folks. As the weeks roll by, this part, thank you, smile, shut up, gets easier. It takes some practice, but I slowly start to get better at it. Thank you, smile, shut up. And what happens is, when I give myself permission to just hear the compliments and not apologize for the compliments or brush them off or negate the compliments, I start to appreciate the compliments. The compliments mean something to me. More important, the fact that someone paused to take the time to give me a compliment means something to me. No one is obligated to compliment you. They do it out of kindness. They do it because they want to. They do it because they believe the compliment they're offering. So when you negate someone's compliment, you are telling them they are wrong. You're telling them they wasted their time. You're questioning their taste and judgment. You are insulting them. If someone wants to compliment you, let them. But that's not enough. That's not, I'm starting to realize, even the point. It's like the Wonder Woman pose. Thank you, smile, shut up, is good. It's good for you. But it's a pose. It's a fake it until you make it. It's not real. I can stand and pose like Wonder Woman all day long, but that doesn't make me Wonder Woman. Because when her hands came off her hips and she walked away, Wonder Woman never said to her friend, "No, gosh, I'm not a hero. The way the world got saved was totally just luck. I hardly did anything. I mean, if I didn't have this lasso and these bracelets, I'd be totally lost. I mean, I'm just a 6-foot-tall Amazon girl with a dream." Wonder Woman would kill that version of herself. She'd run over that meek, chaste Wonder Woman embarrassment with her invisible plane. Wonder Woman does not fake it. Wonder Woman is a study in badassery. It's a word. Badassery. I know it is a word because I just typed it twice. And when my computer asked if I wanted to ignore it or add it to my dictionary, I chose add it to my dictionary. A word that is in the dictionary is definitively a word. Badassery. It's a word. The dictionary kind of sort of said so. Badassery. 1. Noun. The practice of knowing one's own accomplishments and gifts, accepting one's own accomplishments and gifts, and celebrating one's own accomplishments and gifts. 2. Noun. The practice of living life with swagger. Swagger, noun or verb, a state of being that involves loving oneself, waking up like this, and not giving a crap what anyone else thinks about you. Term first coined by William Shakespeare. Wonder Woman is not faking it. Wonder Woman means it. Wonder Woman is all swagger and badassery. Compliment Wonder Woman and she'd be all, "Yeah, I'm a hero. Yeah, I save the world. What's next?" Wonder Woman isn't concerned that her friend is going to feel bad. Wonder Woman isn't concerned that people will think that she thinks that she's better than they are. Because guess what? When it comes to using a lasso and magic bracelets and flying an invisible plane, Wonder Woman is better than they are. She's freaking Wonder Woman. Have you seen her boots? If Serena Williams tells a reporter something like, "I'm the best tennis player you will see in your lifetime," I'm betting she isn't worried that people will think she's better than they are at tennis. Because she's Serena Williams. That's swagger. That's badassery. Want more examples? Do you think Oprah doesn't know she's the best talk show host ever? Do you think that she stays awake at night worried that people think she thinks she's the best? No. And Audra McDonald and her record-setting 6 Tony Awards cannot possibly show up to rehearsal nervous that someone will think she believes she is a better Broadway performer, right? I feel like Julia Child swaggered her booty off. Taylor Swift, all kinds of young badassery. Bae, Malala, Monet Davis, the first female Army Rangers, Misty Copeland, just saying. And I think this is the thing. Everyone's got some greatness in them. You do. That girl over there does. The guy to the left has some. But in order to really mine it, you have to own it. You have to grab hold of it. You have to believe it. Serena's not worried her friend is going to feel bad. She's not as good at tennis as Serena is. You know why? Because in order to be as good as Serena, you have to decide that your goal is that no one is going to be as good as you are at tennis. Then you have to make it true. And you have to be okay with being better than everyone else. One of the most surprising things about Grey's Anatomy becoming a big hit was how unhappy it made me. How scared and sad and nervous and ashamed. My father used to tell us, "The only obstacle to your success is your own imagination." He said it so much that I hear his voice sometimes in my sleep. Of course he was right. But when success came, I did not know what to make of it. Many of my friends were struggling writers. Suddenly I was no longer one of them. I was on the outside, looking in. I was unsure of what this change would mean. I wanted everything to stay the same. I didn't feel like it was okay to celebrate. It's fine to be competitive when you are all on the same playing field, but when you are the only one allowed in the game? I took my trophies and I tucked them in the back of a cabinet, and I didn't talk about the show with anyone who didn't work on the show. Ever. If someone brought it up, I shrugged it off. Ducked my head, waved my hand. "No, don't look at me. This lasso, these bracelets, they're nothing." I was so excited about my job. I was in love with television, in love with the magic of it, the pace, the excitement, the creativity. I wrote interior operating room day, and they built an operating room. Magic. The day after the OR was completed, I spent the entire afternoon in that operating room alone, playing. It was the pantry all over again. I grabbed the paddles and yelled, "Clear!" I waved my arms and shouted, "Damn it, Richard, we have to save him! Clamp!" Dream come true. But when I wasn't at work, it was like it didn't exist. I shoved it all down. It was like this dirty little secret. The phrase, "hide your light under a bushel," comes to mind. And the more I shoved it down, the more dirty it seemed, the unhappier I got. I did not know how to celebrate my success in the face of my friends' continued struggles. I worried that they would think I thought I was a better writer than they were. I put a lot of food on top of it trying to deal with this problem. And by the way, fatness made for a really nice balance. Fat and successful seemed much less threatening. Years went by, more shows were born. And outside of the office, I kept it up. I'm just a writer. I said that a lot. It was my folksy answer to everything. My way of making sure people knew that I didn't think that I was doing anything special. My way of not being arrogant or snotty. I'm just a writer. Not an ounce of badassery here. No swagger in sight. I still couldn't own being powerful. I tried hard to make myself smaller, as small as possible. Tried not to take up space or make too much noise. Every time I won an award or something big happened, I worked to appear a little bit sillier and sweeter and simpler in the face of my own greatness. I just wanted everyone else to feel comfortable. Funny thing is, no one ever asked me to do it. It just seemed like what I was supposed to do. Like what you do. I'm just a writer. If I'm not enjoying all of the success, then see, it isn't such a big deal. I clearly don't think I'm special. I clearly am not loving myself. Yeah, I clearly was not loving myself. Everyone would agree about that. I don't know that I ever would have changed if Dolores hadn't said her 6 words and this year of yes hadn't happened. So yes, I can take a compliment now. Thank you. Smile. But now I've got this new goal. I want it. Badassery. I want to feel free to swagger. I decide, yes, it is okay to go for it. It's not bragging if you can back it up, I whisper to myself in the shower every morning. That is my favorite Muhammad Ali quote. And if you ask me, Ali invented modern-day swagger. I launch myself on a course of full-fledged badassery. People around me notice the change immediately. My 3 closest friends enjoy analyzing it. Scott tells me that it is startling to observe. He tells me that I talk more, that I used to be silent, that he likes this in me. Zola declares, "Your whole energy has changed. The way you fill a room has changed." Gordon tells me I look happy and younger. He thinks my client will have more meetings. I can certainly feel the difference. It is both terrifying and exhilarating. Mentally, I'm trying to be as cocky and immodest and brazen as I can. I'm trying to take up as much space as I need to take up, to not make myself smaller in order to make someone else feel better. I'm allowing myself to shamelessly and comfortably be the loudest voice in the room. I'm never merely lucky. I try hard to think I am special, to be in love with myself, to be into myself. I strive for badassery. Men do it all the time, take the compliment and run. They don't make themselves smaller. They don't apologize for being powerful. They don't downplay their accomplishments. Badassery, I'm discovering, is a new level of confidence in both yourself and those around you. I now feel like I can see so many amazing things about myself and the people around me. It's as if before, by hiding and worrying and being unhappy, I was not looking at the people around me and seeing how truly gifted and amazing they are. There was certainly nothing in me that could have been positive and uplifting or inspiring to them. Not when I was so busy hiding and trying to be smaller and nothing. I've started to think we are like mirrors. What you are gets reflected back to you. What you see in yourself, you may see in others, and what others see in you, they may see in themselves. That's deep. Or it's stupid. Whatever it is, it still all comes down to Wonder Woman. You stand like that in that pose, And after a while, you start to feel like Wonder Woman, and people start to look at you and see Wonder Woman. And oddly, that makes them feel better when they are around you. People like being around whole, healthy, happy people. I was lying in the grass the other day watching my two youngest girls, Emerson and Beckett, race around. They're wearing these light blue, gauzy, frozen superhero capes that my sister Dolores made for them. Now, I know there are no superheroes in Frozen, but I have been experiencing an existential crisis about princesses and feminism and normalizing the images my daughters see and why all the girls' superhero underwear in the stores is pink when no superhero costumes are pink. And look, they're wearing light blue, gauzy, frozen superhero capes because I told them that Anna is a junior superhero with a black sister and a gay brother, both of whom are off ruling other countries because, you know, they have jobs. You do your mothering your way. I'll do my mothering mine. Emerson is making plane noises. Beckett is spinning and spinning and racing around with her chubby, not-quite-two-year-old arms in the air, her curly hair flying. Then Beckett pauses. She looks at me. Mama, she says, grinning. Beckett is always grinning. Mama, I am incredible. Emerson pauses long enough to shout a correction. Incredible. And I am amazing. And then they swagger away. Beckett goes back to spinning. Emerson goes back to her plain noises. Their blue gauzy capes sail in the wind. Would that we were all 2 and 3 years old, I think. They never apologize for their marvelousness. They do not make themselves smaller for anyone. And they, too, make up their own words. That is amazing, incredible badassery. I burst out laughing. I was happy. I am happy. When it comes time to film my part on the Mindy Project, I am ready. I put on all the swagger I've got. I rub myself all over with badassery, and then I head down to the set. What happens next is a whirlwind. I am standing with my favorite actors in a room filled with Dartmouth paraphernalia. The experience of being both in college and inside my TV set at the same time is surreal. I'm told to say a line here and stand there, to look here and go there, move this way and that. I try very hard to be obedient and do what I'm told. I suddenly have a renewed respect for how hard acting in front of the camera is. I also realize that as a writer, I truly do not know what goes down on my sound stages. I have fun. I laugh. They are incredibly kind to me. Ike Barinholtz, who is both the head writer and an actor on the show, becomes my most favorite person ever. I get to take a photo with everyone. I leave with a smile on my face. I don't think I'll ever act again. But if this was my only experience, it was a perfect one. When the episode airs, I do the boldest thing, so full of badassery and swagger. I sit down in the middle of my family room. I turn on my TV, and in real time, I watch the Mindy Project. I do not flinch when I see myself. I do not think, who does that girl think she is? I look myself up and down, and I think, not bad, actually kind of amazing and incredible. Then I put on my blue frozen superhero cape and I do some spinning. Well, I do the adult version of that, which means that I open a great bottle of wine and pour myself a glass. Around the same time, my assistants give me a gift. They know that I'm a political fan the way some people are football fans or baseball fans. I've watched C-SPAN and called it a good time. Election night is my Super Bowl, and I have been in front of the TV for wall-to-wall coverage of every inauguration day since I was a teenager. That President Bill Clinton was on the Ellen DeGeneres show and said something extremely nice about loving everything I did in terms of my TV work was a big deal. I tear the paper off the beautifully wrapped gift. Inside is a T-shirt. The T-shirt reads, "Bill Clinton loves anything I do." In big, bold letters. I love this T-shirt so much that I actually scream with glee when I see it. It's perfect. But it's not for the faint of heart. That shirt is downright cheeky. That shirt takes courage. That shirt takes swagger. It took a lot for me to wear that shirt out of the house. Much badassery was needed. I put it on and wore it out and about for a full day. And when anyone made a comment about it, nice, snarky, or otherwise, I had only one response. Thank you. Smile. Shut up. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go lock door number 2. I've got to go, you see. It's 5:30 swagger o'clock, and I'm late for my applause. A note about time. Yes to more year of yes. I'm well into 2015 when I realize that the year of yes should have ended several months ago. The concept of ending my year of yes leaves me with a hollow feeling. I walk around for a few days thinking maybe I'm coming down with something. As I get ready for bed that night, I realize that what I am coming down with is a very bad case of fear. I am only just beginning to understand that the very act of saying yes is not just life-changing, it is life-saving. I now see 2 paths, a ragged, rocky one that goes up to the top of the mountain, and a nice, easy one that heads down under it. I can fight to make the rocky climb, get a few bruises, risk getting hurt, and I can stand on the mountaintop and breathe the rare air in the warm sun, taking in the whole world before me. Or I can take the easy route underground. There's no sun down there, no air, but it's warm, it's safe. Oh, hey, and there's a big supply of shovels. But really, there's no need to work that hard. The dirt is nice and soft. If I just curl up on the ground, I'll slowly sink deep enough to form my own grave. The years and years of saying no were, for me, a quiet way to let go. A silent means of giving up, an easy withdrawal from the world, from light, from life. Saying no was a way to disappear. Saying no was my own slow form of suicide. Which is crazy, because I do not want to die. As I lie in bed later, I realize I don't want to be done with my year of yes. I am a work in progress. I've just figured out how to have a little swagger. I can't stop now. I don't want to stop now. Do I have to stop now? What began as a small challenge from my sister over chopped onions on Thanksgiving morning has become a life or death endeavor. I am now almost afraid to say the word no. I can no longer answer any challenge with no. That word is no longer an option for me. I know that I can't afford to say it. The cost is much too high. The fear that I may slide back down to the bottom of that mountain, the knowledge of how easy it would be to do so, how comfortable life at the bottom of that mountain is. Well, that is enough to keep the word no from my lips. I can experience life, or I can give up on it. What would happen if I gave up again? Who would I become? How long would it take me to begin the climb again? Would I even have it in me to begin the climb again? Or would that be my ending? I'm not ready for that. I can't end. This is not the end. This isn't the finish line. I'm unfinished. And so, no matter how much I want to, I can no longer allow myself to say no. No is no longer in my vocabulary. No is a dirty word. Time was up. The year was done. But I was not. Which is how the year of yes went from 12 months to forever. I can do that. I can change the challenge if I want to. It's mine. Besides, I'm not running on regular time anymore anyway. Have you checked my clock? I am fully synced up with badassery time. Saying yes is courage. Saying yes is the sun. Saying yes is life. Chapter 11. Yes to no. Yes to difficult conversations. When I was 15, I took my first driver's ed class. I was excited. I had studied the rules of the road. I had my permit neatly folded in my genuine faux leather Duran Duran wallet. I was all about getting my license because once I did, my dad was going to let me drive myself to school in the butter-colored Renault Alliance that was in our driveway. Driving meant freedom. Driving meant that one day so soon, I could drive right out of suburbia and drive right into some place I was meant to be, like Paris. Do not interject with your "don't you know you drive into the ocean, you moron" stuff right now. You're ruining the moment. This was my first driving lesson. All my dreams were coming true. Let me have this one. That afternoon, my mom dropped me off at the public school where driver's ed was offered. I waited patiently for my instructor to arrive, and when he did, I got to climb behind the wheel of a car for the very first time. It was awesome. Totally. Totally. Butterflies zipping around my stomach, I looked at the instructor. Patient and kind, a little balding, he was known as a nice man. He smiled at me, reassuring. I smiled back and asked what he wanted me to do. That is pretty much the last thing I remember. Turns out that what he wanted me to do was start the car and drive out of the parking lot, down the road, up the ramp, and right out onto the freeway. The freeway! Much later, while he was pressing a wet paper towel to my tear-stained face and explaining to me why I didn't need to ever tell this story to my mother who makes Khaleesi and her dragons look like Winnie the Pooh and would have removed his limbs, I learned the instructor had gotten his schedule mixed up. He had mistakenly thought I was another more experienced student. Just before my mom arrived, I asked him what had happened. Did I hit anything? The phrase, "blood drained from his face," is real, y'all. I saw it happen to the instructor. That's the first time I realized that I had been scared literally out of my mind. That is the first time my brain was wiped clean by fear. That was the first painting removed from my wall. And when I look back on it now, all I can think is, why did I let that happen? When the driver's ed instructor told me to turn onto the ramp that led to the freeway, why didn't I put my foot on the brake and put the car in park and look at him and say the one word that would have changed everything? That one word that might have kept the paintings from ever being at risk. One word. No. No is a powerful word. To me, it's the single most powerful word in the English language. Said clearly, strongly, and with enough frequency and force, it can alter the course of history. Want an example? Rosa Parks. Let's butterfly wing Rosa Parks. What if Rosa Parks doesn't say no? What if Rosa Parks says, yeah, okay, fine, dang it, I'll give up my seat and move to the back of this bus? The Montgomery bus boycott does not have its exact perfect hero. A lovely, genteel lady, kind and firm. A lady who captures the imagination and conscience of America, and maybe never happens. My father's people are from Alabama, as are some of my mother's. If the bus boycott doesn't happen, does it alter the course of their lives? Do they never meet in Chicago? Am I never born? Would I be sitting in my house writing this in Los Angeles, California today? Why, hello, narcissism. It has been pages and pages since we've seen each other. How you must have missed me. Yes. Yes, I just suggested that Rosa Parks is saying no on that bus is about me. Did you think I wouldn't find a way to bring everything right back to me? If I can't make an entire civil rights movement about myself, well, what is the point of being a self-centered American? Did I tell you that you had to make Rosa Parks' amazing sacrifice about you? No. No, I did not. No. Most powerful word in the English language. See, you were trying to tell me about my ridiculous self, and I just shut you down. With no. Roll with me, friends. Want another example? When I was making the pilot for Grey's Anatomy, we were lucky enough to work with a seriously brilliant casting director named Linda Lowy. Linda, who, by the way, is one of my favorite people, has a way of just knowing when an actor will be the key that fits the lock that turns the story in my brain. Linda and her partner John have put together every cast of every show I've ever done. Now we have a shorthand. I'll call her up. Linda, I'll say, I need a man. Linda, who is refined and elegant, does not say the thing my friend Gordon would say, which is, everybody needs a man, but you especially need one. Look how tightly you are wound. Get your client to a meeting now. Linda probes a bit to find out what kind of man I'm looking to cast and for what, and then she hangs up the phone, and a week or so later, she'll be on the phone telling me she has found me a man. And that man will be Jeffrey Dean Morgan, or Eric Dane, or Jesse Williams, or I could keep going forever. When I met Linda, I was new to TV.